From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Again and again, as I was reading the recent book, Bad Naturalist by Paula Wyman, I kept thinking, good thing I only have a couple of acres of land. Wyman tackled 200 acres on a Virginia mountaintop, dreaming of reshaping it, she writes, into a native plant paradise, a model of conservation, a meadow that would inspire Julie Andrews to break into song. Well, but the natural world often has other things in mind than the ones on our to-do list, doesn't it? On any scale, learning all the lessons that nature delivers, lessons like ones about invasive plants or about the unstoppable forward march of succession, about the impossibilities of enforcing concepts like control or perfection, are lessons hard learned. And Paula is here today to share some of her takeaways from years of ecological experiments on the land. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Paula Wyman is an author, including of the award-winning book of short stories titled You May See a Stranger. These days, she lives in the Blue Ridge foothills in Virginia on the piece of land that is the subject of her latest book, Bad Naturalist, One Woman's Ecological Education on a Wild Virginia Mountaintop. I'm glad to welcome her to the show today. Hi, Paula. How are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
How's that wild Virginia mountaintop?
It's pretty wild.
So before we get started, I'll say that we'll do a book giveaway with a transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And as I said, sort of hinted at in the introduction, I sort of identify / commiserate, even though I have this tiny place with a lot of the same lessons. So it was kind of fun for me, not fun, but, you know, I guess misery loves company. You know, some of the lessons are startling ones, I guess, that we learn from nature. So let's just have like a mini backstory to set the scene for people. You and your husband were approaching becoming empty nesters, I think, and you sort of were looking for your next home, and you ended up buying a place that didn't even have a house but had 200 acres on a Virginia mountaintop. So tell us, like, when did that begin and the little mini version of the scene setting?
Sure. Well, several years ago, we had been looking for a place, like you said, and we were looking for a house and a small piece of land where...
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't help myself.
I know. Well, my husband is an Eagle Scout, and he wanted to spend more time outdoors, and I wanted to be able to plant a big vegetable garden and maybe raise a few sheep. And when I say a few, I mean like three, not 300. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to plant a small native meadow. When I say small, I mean maybe an acre, mm-hmm. because I had been reading about the importance of native plants. As a kid, I was really into insects and wildlife, and that's sort of how I came to my interest in conservation and ecology. And of course, I learned from reading Doug Tallamy's Nature's Best Hope how important plants are. The right plants, native plants, are for the wildlife that I care about. So I thought, okay, I'm going to plant a small native meadow wherever we end up, and I'll put my writing shed next to it, and I'll watch the birds fly around, and I'll watch the flowers sway in the breeze. And it was all very idealistic and delusional. So we ended up focusing on an area in the northern Blue Ridge in Virginia. And we were out one day looking at homes, and someone said, oh, while you're here, you just have to see the view on top of this mountain. It's incredible. You won't see anything around here like it. So, okay. So we went to this place where, first of all, it was August. It was very hot and bright, and there was no road going all the way up to the top of this mountain. There was a sort of a gravel road at the bottom, so we parked and hiked about a mile up, and when we got out of the woods, we were sort of in this open area, except it was hard to see because the plants were all over our heads. It was sort of a farm that had been allowed to go to seed for quite a while, and there were these 6 foot plus yellow flowers that I couldn't identify because I didn't really know flowers. And there was just a path that was mowed narrow, just wide enough for us to walk through all of this dense vegetation while the bees buzzed around us and all these unfamiliar bird sounds. And we get up to the top and I look out and there is this vast rolling landscape, some steep slopes, some very little flat, some rolling, with all of these yellow flowers as far as I could see, and forested slopes falling away. And I looked out at that, what I later learned was about 75 acres of open meadow, old fields. And I thought, okay, my plan to plant a small meadow seems now very unambitious. And my husband had a similar excited response, not for the same reasons. He was looking at it from the Eagle Scout perspective. I can camp here, I can make trails, right, and all that stuff.
Right.
And in that moment, I basically decided to go for it, that this mountaintop was going to be my project, and I was going to bring native plants back here, not thinking in the moment that I knew very little about plants. And that, right, historically, I'm a terrible gardener. I plant things and they don't come back. So it was not a natural thing for me to decide, but I thought, okay, no, this place needs my help and I'm going to figure out how to do it.
Right. And of course, the first step really that we don't even realize is going to be the first step. And I experienced it here when I came here 35 or more years ago to where I am with a very little, only a couple of acres, but a lot of the same things have presented themselves to me over the years that have revealed themselves to you in the book. Like, we don't know anything about, you know, like you said, yellow flowers. Well, who are they? What are they? You know, and are they annuals, perennials, or biennials? Are they native or non-native? You know, we don't know anything at first, and we start to learn, and we don't know about succession. Are those going to stay, or is something else going to come next? And, you know, so many lessons. And of course, we have the picture in our mind, like you were saying, about I'm going to make a meadow. But even a meadow is not a finished thing, you know, like, oh, it's done.
Right.
Right. It evolves and changes. So, yeah. So, you know, you had to kind of take stock and get familiar, right, with the state of the place, what was there, the baseline, I think, as you call it.
Exactly. I had to really learn the mountaintop. I needed to learn the topography. I needed to learn the plants. And that was a big leap for me because I don't have a background in plants.
Right.
So the first thing I did was start contacting experts, because luckily there were many resources, nonprofit conservation organizations, scientific research institutes, government agencies that would send people out. They would walk with me on the land and they would point things out to me. And that way I received a crash course in ecology, really.
Right.
I learned, unfortunately, I learned to identify invasive plants first, probably.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I especially wanted to really talk about, because, and I laughed at one point in the book, you say you sort of renamed the place Unintended Consequences Farm, you know, because both from the history of who's been there before and what they did, and then, you know, all the human interventions and so forth, and you know, the efforts that you're planning to make, and you're trying to figure out Even if you can identify, once you can identify the invasives and so forth, and oh, we've got to get rid of those. Well, but how? And can we really? And which ones are most important to deal with? And do you know what I mean? There's so many the questions. It's like a triage ward. The questions just, it's like, okay, what's the biggest emergency, right? We have to figure that out. Because we can't do everything, can we?
No, absolutely. And it was really like playing a game of whack-a-mole constantly.
Yes.
I would be concerned with something over on one side of the meadow, and then a half mile away, something terrible would be happening
Right.
that I would find out about when it was too late for me to stop it. So, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I have this giant weed wrench, and I spend an afternoon pulling about 3 dozen autumn olives. That were between
Right.
3 and 5 feet tall.
One
That's
of your invasive woody plants, the autumn
yes.
olive Eleagnus, and it's a terrible invasive because it has makes so many seeds and the birds move them around and it's a bad one.
And they were, like so many other invasives, planted intentionally in a lot of
Yes.
places.
Yes, yes.
And they even intentionally planted a variety that would make the most seeds because they thought that would be a good thing.
Right.
So that's what we're dealing with. But then I pulled those up, and then I walked up the hill and I saw in another spot a bunch of Jimson weed plants coming up where I didn't know that we had them. So that was going to be a project for another day. And things like that happen all the time. I can't do everything, so I do have to prioritize. And I sort of try to deal with things that can be treated directly, like invasive trees, like the tree of heaven, ailanthus, the paulownia, and then the autumn olive.
Right.
I try to deal with those because it's easy to find them. They can be treated once or twice, and then they're done. Although we always have more.
Right.
But things like vines, I find very difficult. Like Japanese honeysuckle. We have that throughout some of the fields. And this is one of the things that I learned in the process of this project, that conservation, at least ecological restoration, was going to be about trade-offs. I was constantly going to be making difficult decisions about what to help when it meant possibly harming something else. So if I try to go through the fields now and treat the Japanese honeysuckle, I'm also going to kill a lot of milkweed
Right.
and goldenrod and little bluestem. And so I have to make decisions about where and when is it okay to do that. And I have a really hard time with that because I don't
Right.
like to kill anything good.
And I really identify with that. I've really, in terms of, using herbicide or whatever, and I haven't really, and now I have in my so-called meadow, which is a small meadow above my house. It wants to be a shrubland now. It's at the stage of succession after so long of like a once yearly mowing kind of a thing. It was a bluestem kind of dominated little meadow and a little bluestem meadow, and it wants to be kind of rubus, whatever the, it wants to be, and I don't know whether they're technically blackberries or what they are exactly. I've never keyed them out, but it just wants to be a thicket. Figuring those things out and deciding, well, okay, what do I do? Do I mow it for X number of years to really discourage the woodies, or do I, go to the herbicide? And in that case, it wouldn't be broadcast spraying, but what do I do? And as you say, there can be unintended consequences. And as you write in the book, we're constantly having to come to terms with imperfection, aren't we? That there,
Yes, that was also very difficult for me, a difficult lesson to learn. I really thought someone was going to come to me and say, okay, first you do this, then you do
Right. Like a
that.
recipe book, right? Like it's like
Exactly.
we're making a recipe, we're building something, and there's a formula. No, it's and you also say having to do with the invasives, you say that you stopped saying getting rid of invasives and started saying managing invasives. And I think that's a very important point, is that once we really dig in and start trying to do some of these things, we recognize that there are limitations. There are literally forces bigger than us at work, and we have to think about the trade-offs, as you're saying, and what the best possible outcome is, which is not 100%, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I really needed to learn that lesson about the invasive plants because I was kind of letting it take over my life and in my mind. I was
Right.
having dreams about the tree of heaven marching through
Oh dear.
the meadow.
Oh dear.
Yeah, no, it wasn't good. So, and I can't help it when I'm on the highway, they grow along the median and that's what I see. You know, ailanthus everywhere. And of course, now we have spotted lantern flies. So it's even worse that we have ailanthus trees. But it's, you know, we're not going to necessarily stop them from coming. We can only, yeah, manage them.
And another interesting thing that you confronted, and it's something that I've confronted here too with a different species. Speaking of woody sort of invasives or things that appear to be invasive, sometimes they're not non-natives. Sometimes they're just pioneer species. You learned about pioneer species thanks to the tulip poplar, the liriodendron, which is a native tree, yes?
Yes, exactly. And we have some fields where tulip poplars have tried to take over, and we really are trying to keep those out of the meadow for a lot of reasons. And people might say, well, why don't you just let it go to closed canopy forest? But this mountaintop, a large part of it has probably not been closed canopy forest for hundreds of years. And its natural inclination might be is more likely savanna. So we're trying to maintain as much of it that way as we can. And the more it goes to, so we spend a lot of time, my husband actually spends a lot of time cutting poplar trees and also black locust trees. Those are the two pioneers, sassafras somewhat, but I love the sassafras trees and I
I
won't
know, but
cut
boy, oh boy, when they
them.
want to make a sort of a thicket, an outcrop, I don't even know what you would call it. They're pretty lusty.
Yeah.
They're
Yeah.
beautiful, so beautiful, especially in the fall, of course. Here, it's the pioneer species, sort of from my property, surrounded by state forest, and is a black birch, a particular type of birch. And at first, when it kind of, I wanted to mow less and less and less, and I stopped mowing to sort of the outer fringes and all the way out to the fence, and I sort of let things sow in. Like I got a lot of native witch hazelwood self-sow and other things, other woody plants, and again, reducing the mowing. And what came in were these young trees, and I was like, oh, look, they're a native, black birch. And well, the thing is, they grow really fast, and there's a lot of them. And like you said, like with the tulip poplar, you're going to pretty quickly have a tulip poplar forest, or I'm going to have a black birch forest,
Exactly.
and so
So,
that wasn't exactly the idea. So, but it's really hard to edit sometimes. It's hard to understand that. And again, coming to understand pioneer species and the idea that in nature, in the succession process, there are these leaders that are at the vanguard, these ones that go out first and mark the territory, right?
yes. But I just don't want even with native plants, I don't want a monoculture.
Well, exactly. And that's what I mean is that, but I
Yeah.
didn't, in the beginning, I didn't even know what pioneer speak. I mean, I didn't know anything like that. And when I started to know about native plants, I thought, oh, they're all good. That's all perfect. They're on the good side. And then there's the bad guys. But again, there's this fuzzy gray area in the middle where, as you
Yes.
say, right? So we learn these subtle, more subtle lessons along the way in these experiments that we're crazy enough to be doing.
And I've had a similar problem with blackberry that it will very quickly take over a field, and then you have a shrubland, like you were saying. And I tried different ways of dealing with that. We basically have settled on mowing or bush hogging, which is sort of mowing on steroids. But it's not perfect, you know. It's going to grow back, and mowing can actually encourage that woody bramble.
Right.
But I didn't want to spray it, and that's what I was advised to do. And I said,
Right.
no, I'm not going to spray it because so many bees and animals use this plant. That's not why I'm here. I did want to burn it because you can burn woody stuff if you burn in the fall, but the Department of Forestry has been so short-staffed and
Yes, and
burdened.
here too. And we've had, like last year, we had a drought year, for instance. And so, the burn seasons, there was no burn season in the fall last year where I am because of a drought and, things like that. I mean, it's not like you just go do it whenever you feel like it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah, yeah. No, it's very, very specifically supervised, especially on your larger scale.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, there is a course that I could take to become a certified burn manager, but I think even if I were to do that, I would
Yeah.
not feel comfortable supervising a burn
Yeah.
on the mountain. It's just
Yeah. No, no,
too
no, no.
dry and
That's
highly
big. That's big.
erodible and yeah.
So we have maybe 5 minutes to talk, and I wanted to sort of say to you, so you call yourself the bad naturalist. And so I want to ask you about that, but I also wanted to say, what would be sort of for, gardeners who are transitioning whatever amount of space, because again, I find the same lessons on 1/100th of the space that you have, that I've come across the same lessons you have, and I think it doesn't matter how big or small the space.
Absolutely.
What would be some of the sort of standout bits of sort of advice or whatever lessons learned that you would want people to be thinking about as they think about a more ecological approach to part or all of their property?
Well, I think the first step, at least for me, was to pay attention to what's growing around you, right where you live, and be curious about what these plants do. How do they support the local natural community? And think about, is there something in there that maybe isn't pulling its weight, that you don't really care about. Like, don't get rid of your favorite ornamental shrub, but start small and pick one corner of your yard or one pot if you're planting in pots or your window box, and plant one native plant that does something that will engage your interest. So if you're into birds or if you're into butterflies, plant a native plant that will appeal to those creatures because it's so motivating when you do something like that and you see bees or butterflies or whichever interests you coming to that plant. And you know that if you hadn't done that, it wouldn't have happened. It happened because of you. So this small thing made a difference. So my whole thing is don't put so much pressure on yourself to make big change all at once.
Right.
Start small, take steps, and choose something that you really care about.
Okay. So sort of an almost in a way specialize in a way at first so that you get that sense of connection and success and so forth, that you get to observe the change you want to see happen. You hopefully get to observe it happen. Okay.
Yeah. So for instance, if you wanted to plant milkweed because it would attract monarchs, once you see a monarch there, we'll also think about planting aster or goldenrod so that
Right.
the adult monarchs have something, and then
Right.
you'll really have this nice little mini ecosystem that supports those butterflies
Right.
through their whole lifespan.
Right. So go from that first little nugget of a lesson and expand outward from there, okay?
Exactly.
Okay. So that's one for sure to start small and with something that you really care about, a focus.
Yeah,
A
and I think
focus.
that sort of when you see that you did something like that you made something happen, it's empowering and it leads to next steps. It leads
Right.
you to want to do more.
And you got a lot of advice and help, and you didn't, follow the first person who said do this or do that, like, you know, broadcast spray the whole place or whatever. You didn't do those things, but you did solicit advice. And isn't that an important, isn't, don't you think it was
Absolutely.
valuable?
Absolutely. I would say definitely investigate the resources where you live, because many counties and towns and states have programs that support planting of natives, even capturing rainwater, all kinds of programs like that, that they may, you know, they may start with free advice, or they might even partly subsidize the planting of native plants.
Right. And there's
So,
organizations like membership organizations like Wild Ones with chapters all around the country, you
yeah.
know, that are going to, if you can find neighbors who have firsthand experience in your area, that kind of thing. So sort of networking and getting expert advice, I think, is super important too.
Yes, exactly. And in our case, the Soil and Water Conservation District also was willing to come out and take a look and give advice. And there's an organization called Blue Ridge Prism, which, even though Blue Ridge is in the name, they get people from all over the world tuning into their webinars about invasive plants,
Oh, okay. We'll
which,
give a link to that with the transcript. Great.
yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I'm glad to talk to you. I was glad to read the book, and congratulations on that, bad naturalist or otherwise. And may the adventure continue, you know. I mean, that's what it's all about. So thank you for making time today to talk, and I hope I'll talk to you again.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.